Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 15th of Iyar. We begin with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, to David Hochhauser for their help in putting together these shiurim. And today we get to see a meshiv, a respondent that we don't see very often. I'm not even sure we've seen him ever. This is from Shut Divrei Chaim. Divrei Chaim is a book of response written by Rabbi Chaim ben Rabbi Aryeh Leib Halberstam, who is better known as the Sanzer Rebbe. He was born in Tarnogrod, Poland, in 1793. Like an early Eloi, he becomes the Rav of a town called Rudnik at the age of 18. He gets closer in that town to Hasidut by 1830, when he's appointed the Rav of Tzanz. He's now a Rebbe, not just a Rav, and it becomes an important Hasidic center, and he becomes, you know, one of the prominent Hasidic Rebbeim of Poland and Hungary, and he passes away in Tzanz in 1876. And the Shoot was published in 1875, very much towards the end of his life. So I found the tshuva of his, and since one of my goals here is to, over the course of selecting and finding tshuvot, so one of my goals is to connect, and I don't know if I've ever said this to you before, if you haven't realized it, one of my goals is to connect us to the calendar better, right? I think that it's good that Jews should know what their calendar says. It might even be a mitzvah in the Torah to know that. But so if you know that today is the 15th of Iyar because you hear a response written on the 15th of Iyar, that's one very small goal, and this is a lot of work for just that small a goal, but it is a goal. Another goal, though, is of mine is to eventually get a chance to look at sort of a random selection of tshuvot and see what is common to all of them, what unites them, because to me that would be a strong argument in favor of these are common and essential elements of what it means to be a Jewish halachist, because we find this range of people over a range of topics, over a range of days, and a range of tshuvot, and this is what is common to all of them, what unifies all of them. So every time I find a new meshiv who I can include, that sort of helps randomize the sample and helps us see that if we end up with some common links, maybe we'll end up with nothing. That happens too, in which case it'll just have been the pleasure of learning from these great rabbis that we'll have had together. In any case, for today, we're going to look at Shut Divrei Chaim Yeredeya Bet Pei Zayin, Volume 2, response number 87, and it is from the 15th of Iyar of Tuf Reish Chaf Aleph of 1861. It's to a Rav in a town in Deutschland, which I think means Germany, but it's the 1870s, so I'm not sure they refer to it quite that. They refer to it as Deutschland. So this man who's writing to him is writing about the rabbi of their community. The rabbi of their community, whose job, one of his jobs, was to make sure that all the Jewish services in town function well. So he would be the mashgiach on the kashrus, for example, and things like that. One of the elements of that is to keep the mikvah kosher. So a mikvah, for people who don't necessarily know, a mikvah is a body, is a collection of water, and it's got several purposes, but the main purpose that for Jews today and in the 1800s was that women went there after they had menstruated and completed menstruating, gone through all the process of being a nida, all the process of being mitaheret from being a nida, finishing with her nida status, and then what finally finishes that halachically is she goes to mikvah. There are things you use mikvah when you buy new pots and pans or various sorts of new dishes, new glasses, you have to dip them in a mikvah. Some men go to mikveh every day, that is a custom. Some men only go to mikveh around Rosh Hashanah and Kippur time, but men sometimes go to the mikveh. But I think more regularly what it's used for, and more seriously, because until a woman goes to mikveh, she is a nida. She retains the status of nida, and to have relations with a nida is an isur karet. It is a prohibition of both of them that if they did it on purpose, would incur the punishment of karet. That, by the way, is one of the reasons to think about the fact, the seriousness of what in common English parlance is called premarital sex. So unless a woman's going to mikvah, and then all women are nidot until they go to mikvah. So for most women, that's until they get married, which would mean that when we look at that, if it happens that there are people out there, for whatever reasons, having relations before they get married, and the woman hasn't gone to mikvah, then they are committing an isur karet. And an isur karet, you know, if you think about what other isur karet are, eating on Yom Kippur is an isur karet. Eating chametz on Pesach is an isur karet. Not getting circumcised your whole life is an isur karet. So isur karet are very serious things, and there are many, many, many other sexual ones. Many, many of the gilui arayot, of the sexual acts that we think of as being so immoral that they are part of gilui arayot, is our isur karet, are punishable by karet. So to me, this is not even the tshuva at all. I'm just sorry for the digression. email me if you don't like my digressions, G-R-O-T-H, or if you do, G-R-O-T-H-S-T@gmail.com. But it's a reminder that there are things that we look at and they become normalized to us. We think it's not such a big deal. Yeah, it's preferable not to do it, but what are you going to do when it's really very serious? You wouldn't set up a social structure in which a bunch of people were eating chametz on Pesach because they were tempted and didn't matter that much to them. And so they ate chametz on Pesach. Well, you knew that was happening regularly. I think people would gishrei gevalt. I think they would, and I don't speak Yiddish even. I think they would cry about it. They would yell about it. They would do something. They would say, we have to do something about this. But on this one, I'm not sure that that's true. In any case, in this town, that wasn't the issue. The issue was they had a mikvah, and the job of this rabbi was to check the mikvah. And he checked it regularly. And then one day he realizes, instead of it having the 44,000 finger breaths worth of water, so a mikvah's measurements are, I don't even know what the amounts of liquid are. It has to be in the terms of gallons today. I think in the Gemara it's supposed to be 4 amot by 1 amma by 1 amma, so it would be, you know, that cubic amot, I guess 4 cubic amot, whatever that turns out to be in water, and it's whatever it is, right? Or 40 sa'ah of mayim is the mikvah, is the minimum, and I forget what a sa'ah is in regular thing. But so their calculation was, it was 44,000 etzba'ot, and how they figured it out. And then he realized it only had 33,000, and it's been 14 years that women have been immersing in this mikvah. In all sincerity, they've come at the time of the month when it's time for them to come to the mikvah. They come to the mikvah. They immerse themselves in the mikvah. They think they're fine. They go back to their houses and they go back to their lives. Now, in halacha, the rabbi who made this mistake, there's two ways you could have made that mistake. One mistake is what's called Shiga Talmud. So Shiga Talmud would be, let's say he had come to believe or understand, or he just hadn't learned the halachas well enough, and he decided that 33,000 of these fingers worth was enough water in the mikvah, right? Let's say the amount is 40 sa'ah. Let's pretend that that's 40 gallons. It's, I think, a lot more than 40 gallons. Let's pretend it's 40 gallons. And he came to decide, now it's 32 gallons. And so for 14 years, he ran a mikvah that had 32 gallons in it. That would be, so the guy writing the letter to the Sanzer Rebbe says, that would be Shigat Talmud Lezadon. There's a Mishnah Perkei Avot that says, you got to be careful about your learning, because mistakes you make in learning that you should have known don't count as mistakes the same way, because, at least for Rebbe Yonah there on the Mishnah says, because you're supposed to know better, you're supposed to learn it better, or look it up, or whatever. So those kinds of mistakes are much more serious. But this guy's point is, the mistake wasn't that. It wasn't that kind of mistake. That's a very terrible mistake. This mistake is terrible too. But it's a more sincere mistake. It's that when he was measuring it, he mixed up, or he didn't remember or notice that he was using an amat ha-sochrim haktana as opposed to an amat ha-binyan ha-gdola. He was using the measuring stick that merchants use, which is a smaller measure than the measuring stick that builders use. Okay, so the parallel to that would be, let's say he had a ruler or a tape measure, and it had a side of it that was in metrics and a side of it that was in, you know, ordinary feet and yards and things like that. And he thought he was measuring meters, and he was really measuring inches. So since 1 meter is 39 inches, and he might have thought a foot was a meter, then he was measuring 12 inches as if it was 39. So that's not quite the same numbers here, but that's the kind of thing that's going on. He made a mistake in the tool he was using to measure it, and he just never thought about it because he was so clear. This is the tool I use to measure the mikvah, and it comes out the mikvah is kosher. He goes every month, or whenever, however often you check the mikvah. He checked, it was always kosher. So he's doing what he thinks she should be doing. The women coming to mikvah are doing what they think they should be doing, and then now, he's realized the error. He doesn't know what he did, what to do about it, and he's very upset, and he feels very bad, and he's not sure what to do about it, and he is worried that the chet harabim, that the sin of all these married couples who had relations when the wife was in nida, I fully understand, and the Sanzer Rebbe fully understands, that they didn't know what they were doing, and we'll get to that, but he's worried that all of this is on him, so he's very upset. So that would be one problem. And not only that, his wife has used this mikvah all these years, and so he is part of the problem, meaning he's part of this issue. He's had relations with his wife when she was a nida, and he didn't realize she was a nida because they thought the mikvah was good. So he doesn't want to know what to do. Now, for hundreds of years, for centuries, Jews, and it's still around today, but very often I feel like it's less around than it used to be. People who realized they had done a sin felt that not only did they have to express their remorse, that they knew, they had to express their remorse and feel bad about it, and do the four steps of tshuva that we know. Although I have to say, in our times on Yom Kippur, people do that. But the four steps are to recognize the sin, which means to admit, say, yes, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done this. Very hard step. Then to decide not to do it in the future. Also a very hard step. It's easy to decide it, but to keep to it is a very hard step. To recognize it, to regret it. You could say, oh, yeah, that's what I did, and it's a sin, but I don't feel bad about it. It's just what it is. So that's not tshuva. Tshuva is I regret it. And then I mekabel atid, I plan not to do it again, and I really mean not to do it again. And then I say vidui, and then I articulate it. But in starting at least from the time of Sefer Chassidim in the 1100s, in Germany, there's been an additional acceptance of acts of penitence, as it were. Whether or not this has an influence from the non-Jews is a whole question. I'm not getting into that now. But the idea that you'd have a tshuva, you would do things. So some people held, like Rabbeinu Yonah, for example, would have held that the do things is you do more mitzvos, you focus more on making sure to do kindnesses, you focus more on learning Torah, maybe you fast a couple of times, but you do things. And then Sefer Chassidim would think, and people like that, thought you also accepted upon yourselves fast for sure, and other kinds of ways of showing your regret and showing how much it bothers you that you did it. So this man is trying to figure out, what should I do? How can I make up for this? Imagine 14 years of people going to mikvah, not knowing the mikvah's puzzle, so they're having relations. So all of that is on you because you're the rabbi who made the mistake that led to it. So the Tzanzer Rebbe is writing back. He says, I got your letter. He says, if you look at the Gemara in Pesachim and Ayin Bet Amud Bet, you might think there's a way to sort of absolve the people of the town a little bit. The Gemara in Pesachim Ayin Bet Amud Bet says, Rav Yochanan Amar Ishto Nida Ba'al Chayav, if a man has relations with his wife when she's a Nida, and he didn't ask her, and he didn't say, are you a Nida, and the Gemara's tradition, I don't think this is the way it should be, but the Gemara's understanding was that women in that situation might feel uncomfortable stopping their husbands, right? That's one of the lasting questions in male-female relations, and it's a continuum, and people will say, oh, obviously I should be at this end of the continuum or that end of the continuum. The continuum is how much in a husband-wife relationship does the wife speak up. So some will say, well, she should be fully equal. Some will say she should be more equal, so speak up whenever she wants. In the time of the Gemara, I'm not saying this is what should be, I'm not saying this is the model that we necessarily have to follow in all its ways, but the time of the Gemara, the assumption was that at least when it came to a sensitive topic like marital relations, if the husband initiated marital relations, the wife would be very loath to stop him. Right or wrong, good or bad, could be adjusted, could not. But in any case, the Gemara says, so, if a man has a relationship with his wife and she doesn't say anything and it turns out she's a nida, that's on him. That's on him because the Gemara's assumption is that he could and should have asked her before it happened. Yevimto baal patur. But if he has his relations, and I think it might be the first time when they're first getting married, with the woman who's the widow of his deceased brother who died without children, so only when a man passes away without children, in the time of the Gemara, even today in some communities, but rarely, the brother of the deceased can and should, it's a mitzvah in the Torah, to marry the widow, and there's some sense in which the Torah says that that marriage, the child they produce, will be mekim shem, will be a continuation of the line of the deceased brother. However that works, and that's not our topic today. But there, the Gemara says, with Yevimto, Baal Patur, the man is actually patur. He's not allowed to do it, but he's not chay of kares for having done it. And the reason is, yevimto bazizmina. He is still embarrassed around her. He is shy, as it were. He is abashed around her, and therefore he won't feel comfortable asking her if she's a nida or not. However that works in the Gemara, that's not our topic today. The reason why it's relevant to our discussion, the Tzanzer Rebbe brings it up, is you might have thought here, we could say all of the B'nai Ha'ir, all of the town members who use the mikvah, we could say maybe they're p'turim, maybe they don't have any real liability because they're buzzies minei from the Chacham, because they're not going to ask the Chacham, the rabbi, the local town scholar, every month, are you sure you checked the mikvah right? Are you sure you used the right tool, right? That's embarrassing to him and to them. So they won't do it. So it would make seem, like the Gemara is saying, that in cases where it's legitimate for a person to not have asked a question because of the interpersonal relations issues there, and that means that it would be uncomfortable to ask the question, that if somebody unfortunately transgressed the Torah by virtue of not asking for that halachic question, then maybe they're patur. Right? We say they're patur. And then the question then becomes, what does that word patur mean? When we say he's patur, so patur in some context means no liability whatsoever, right? You know, if somebody goes to court and the court He rules on their issue. They said they're putter means they're not obligated. They, you know, in a money case, means they're not obligated. It doesn't mean you really should pay him back. It means that's the way the halacha goes. You're not obligated. So here you might have thought putter means they have no obligation. The reason would be kimbo onus. That since the husband, since the yabam, the lever is the English word for it, I have no idea why, since the yabam is legitimately discreet about the questions that he's willing to ask this Yavama, his future wife, and he's not comfortable asking whether she's in Ida. Now, I would have thought she should speak up, but however it works, you'd think you'd want to prepare for that. But the Gemara says, Patur, you think it means Patur, like he didn't have any choice. He didn't have any way to get to the information, therefore he's not obligated at all. That would be then all the more so. Here they had a psak. Right? If you have a psak, that's always legitimate. That always legitimate to some extent what you're doing, because I can just have a psak. I remember times when there were foods that I wasn't sure were necessarily kosher. When I walked into a kosher, one time actually, it was a long time ago, it was cranberry sauce. My mother, I was still shopping, you know, still unmarried and shopping for my mother. She sent me to a store looking for cranberry sauce, and I couldn't find any cranberry sauce that had hashgacha on it. And I didn't know what to do about it. And finally, I walked into, there was a local kosher store. I don't know why I had gone there to begin with, but it was a local kosher store. And they had the exact same brand of the cranberry sauce that I had been looking for in all the places without hashgacha. And they had it without hashgacha. And so apparently they had assumed that you didn't need hashgacha. And I said, you know what? This kosher store, they're religious enough for me. And if they think it's kosher, then I think it's kosher. So that idea that you can rely on a chacham is a real idea in many contexts. If you get a psak from a chacham, from a Torah scholar, a legitimate and a qualified and appropriate Torah scholar, that provides some cover for you. So you might say, so I'm an onus. I had no choice. I went to my, you know, take a simpler case. If there's some question about a woman is needy or not, having nothing to do with a mikvah, some question, you go to your local rabbi and he tells you what to do and you go do it. We think that you're probably okay. Even if he later says, you know, I made a mistake, I was wrong, we would have thought you were okay. So Sanza Rebbe says that's not the way to understand it. Ulam be'emet in ata'am sham mishim onus. That Gemara in Pesach doesn't mean they're an onus, that it's out of their control. And the proof is that we have a much better example. The Gemara in Horayot, Horayot is a whole tractate of Gemara about, that starts with the question, based on a psukim in the Torah, that starts with the question of what happens when the courts get halacha wrong. So the Torah sets up a special korban, a special sacrifice, in cases where the Sanhedrin gets the topic wrong on a serious issue. It's got to be an issue that has karet ramifications, and they get it wrong, and the majority of the Jewish people act upon their hora'ah, their instructions, their decision. So there the halacha is, the Jewish people will only bring one korban to atone. So the Tzadzer Rebbe points out, what the Mishnah actually says, what the Gemara actually says, is, diyachid she'asal pi horat beit din, an individual who gets a psak from a court, and then it turns out the court says, no, you know what, we got it wrong, that individual is chayav korban. So let's say, you know, an easy example would be, let's say a court, a guy comes to a court and he says, I have this, you know, Shmirat Shabbat question. So halachically, if you violate Shabbat in front of other people with witnesses and all that, God forbid, the court can put somebody to death. But let's say they do it either without witnesses, so that would be a karet. And if they do it unintentionally, meaning not fully realizing the halachic ramifications of what they were doing, so that would be a chiyuv korban, right? I don't remember that it's Shabbat on the day, or I don't realize that it's Shabbat, right? I'm plowing my field Shabbat Friday afternoon, and I think Shabbat starts at 5:30. I don't realize they've changed the clock, or I don't notice the sun going down, and I end up that I plowed on Shabbat. I get home, I realize I ended up just plowed on Shabbat. I have to bring a korban. Another, right, so that's a shogeg. In the case of shogeg, I have to bring a korban. So if the court decides that X act is not a full Shabbat violation, and therefore it's allowed to do, or even theoretically, I think, actually they say it's a derabbanan, it turns out to be a karet, a full biblical prohibition, I think that counts as well. I didn't check that recently, but I think that counts as well. So a guy goes to court and says, you know, there's this newfangled technology called, you know, pick a technology that you want. Am I allowed to use this new technology on Shabbat? And the court says, thinks about it, they deliberate, they look into it, they find out the technicalities, how it works, they say, yes, you're allowed to use it on Shabbat. It goes off, use it on Shabbat once. The next week, they realized there was an element of the technology, either they didn't understand well enough, or they didn't think about it well enough, and they were wrong, and you're not allowed to use it on Shabbat. He has to bring a korban. Yes, they made the mistake, but he did the act. So he has to bring a korban. So what does that prove? And so too the Rambam Paskin says the Tzenzer Rebbe Paskin's that way. And also we Paskin in Yevamot, he points out the Tzenzer Rebbe in Yevamot, Tzadi Ben Amad Aleph, the Davar Ta'ut Lo Mikre Hora'ah. That when they make a mistake, it's not even considered a hora'ah. So when we say that you follow the instructions of Beit Din, that you have to bring a korban, sometimes their instructions don't even count as instructions, and then you certainly have to bring a korban. And now, even if the majority of the Jewish people make the mistake, and the Beit Din HaGadol gave the instruction, they still have to bring a korban. It's just that they only have to bring one korban instead of many korban. The Torah didn't say if the Sanhedrin gives a ruling, and the entire or the majority of the Jewish people follow that ruling, it's okay. It says that they're only going to bring one korban because the whole nation will have done something, and therefore they can have one representative korban. But they still need a korban. It says that the Tzenzer Rebbe, from the fact that there's a need for a korban, for a sacrifice, it shows you that even doing something unwittingly has a sin element to it. So, and he says, so don't ask me, but how could that be true? What could they have done? They're anusim. We have this katz b'dalach. We have an absolute katz b'dalacha. Ones rachmana patre. Now, when somebody does something against their will without being able to have avoided it, then they're patre. Then the Torah says they're fine. It's not their problem, right? So I couldn't have avoided it in whatever way, right? I trip as I'm walking and I bump into a light switch and I turn off the light switch. That's an onus. I couldn't have avoided it, right? So things that I couldn't avoid, right? I open my mouth, I sneeze, and as I'm sneezing, a fly or some other non-kosher thing comes in and goes down my throat, which is disgusting and terrible for other reasons, but it's a notice. I'm not in any way liable. So you might see here too. They went to the court. Court told them what to do. They did it. That isn't that an onus? Isn't that nothing they couldn't? It was unavoidable. The answer is, he says, the Torah, and this is, I think, the reason why I chose this tshuva, or why it jumped out and struck me, aside from the fact that it was an opportunity to learn from another meshiv that we don't always learn from, is this idea that he's about to express to us here that a shogeg is not the same thing as an onus. We tend to think, oh, I did it by accident means that not liable. See, here, by accident is an important category. It says, Tatorach Yiva Korban Shogeg Be'ezo Ofen Sheyeh. If you're a shogeg, then it counts. So see, the difference is that an onus is they could not have avoided it. Not, they didn't know what they were doing. Didn't know what they were doing fully, that's not an onus. Didn't know what they were doing is a shogeg. Now, shogeg is also not liable as if they did it on purpose. Not like Hashem says, oh, you're such an evildoer because you did this act. But you did an act that was an act of sin. An onus category, he doesn't lay it out quite like this, but I'm pretty sure this is what he means. An onus is where you didn't do the act because it wasn't an act you did. But if you didn't act, just you didn't know what the nature of the act was, that's shogeg. Here's another good example, and people don't realize this either. There is a category in the Gemara, and it's much used today, because today is used to sort of excuse in some way the people who don't keep the Torah, and to say, well, they're not liable for what they did because they're a tinok shenish, but because they are like babies who were taken captive by non-Jews, you know, let's say by babies who were taken and converted to Catholicism at a young age, so how liable could they be? They didn't know anything. They didn't even know they were Jewish necessarily, right? What can you expect of them? Tzenzer Rebbe says, but he points out, so, and that Jew therefore never knows, or that Jew who was captured by them and raised as a non-Jew, maybe never knew there was an obligation of Shabbat in the world. He never understood such a thing, right? So today, probably most non-Jews, most certainly Christian and Muslim non-Jews, know there's a concept of Shabbat, and that would, but if he never knew he was Jewish, this Tinok Shadish Bar, she never knew she was Jewish, or she knew she was Jewish but never realized that there's an actual concept of Shabbat, and that's sort of the reason that people use today for people who are raised completely in branches of Judaism that deny halacha in many, many ways. They'll say, oh, they're like a Tinok Shadish Bar. So the Tzadzer Rebbe's point is that the mission in the beginning of the seventh parak of Shabbat, the seventh chapter of Shabbat, says that such people, when they realize they're Jewish and they come to become, you know, come back to the fold, as it were, they're obligated to bring a korban. They might only bring one korban, one sacrifice, for all the years they didn't keep any of a particular sin because they didn't know what they were doing, and therefore might all count as one not knowing. But the fact that we assign a korban is an example of that they are counting as shogegim. They're not anusim. They're shogegim. It's not that they couldn't have avoided this action. It's that they didn't know what they were doing. They didn't realize the full ramifications of their actions. That makes them a shogeg. So his point is that a shogeg, even if, so another example of that he doesn't bring up, but I think it's also Another good example is an omer mutar. In halacha, counts as a shugeg. An omer mutar is somebody who thinks that something is permissible. That would mean, you know, you have a halachic debate, people have halachic things, you know, you have some topic in the world of halacha, you come down on a side that says it is permissible, it turns out you're right, you act on it, turns out you're wrong. However, it turns out you're wrong. That's a whole question how you figure out you're wrong. But it turns out you're wrong. Not just that we end up deciding to paskin like so-and-so. And if the Jewish community or the majority of the Sanhedrin ends up deciding like paskin like so-and-so, and prior to that somebody had followed another opinion, that's not what we're talking about here. That's a whole different discussion. But an omer mutar thinks it's mutar for a long time. It's done it because they thought it was mutar. Turns out it's aser. That's a show gig. That's not honest. See, but they really thought it was mutter. That's true. They really thought it was allowed. So Hashem will certainly factor that in judging them, but it counts as a show gig. It's an unwitting violation of the Torah. It's not a non-violation by virtue of the fact that they could not have done anything else. So with the Yavama then, when we say, back when we said that since he's embarrassed to ask her status and they have relations, that he'd be putter, the answer is not because it's an onus, it's because he was a ta'av bidvar mitzvah ve'asa mitzvah. It's because he made a mistake. He needed to ask her. That was his obligation. He thought, you know what, it's a mitzvah to do yibum. I'll just do yibum when I want to make it uncomfortable for anybody, so I won't ask her any questions. So that's what he says. So therefore, that's clearly a shogeg example. It's a shogeg example with lots of mitigating factors. It's a shogeg. It's an unwitting violation of the Torah, not a non-violation. Another example that I'm raising in Hilchos Shogeg is, let's say a woman whose husband goes to on a faraway trip and is lost, and however it happens, the court thinks, there are witnesses who say they saw that he had passed away, sadly, or there was one witness who said they say, that you're okay, you can get married. So she has permission from a court to marry, and then she marries a second guy, and then the husband comes back, however that happens. And unfortunately, and there was a time certainly when it happened more often than now, and it was an issue. So the Gemara says that not only is she obligated to bring a korban, a sacrifice, because she violated the Torah by violating her marital vow, she committed adultery, the second husband did too, even though, again, you could have said, he is an honest, what could he have done? Right? He had a beit din who said he could do it, and marrying a woman is mitzvah d'oraita, and nonetheless, we paskin chayav a korban, a chatat. So anyway, there's a whole question there he gets into that I don't want to get into now, because it's not really our topic, but the fundamental answer is, even in the case of an Nida, he has some suggestion that maybe the Nida, the woman is the one who's obligated, responsible to make sure she's okay, and therefore the husband wouldn't be as liable, but he doesn't end up thinking that, so I'm not going to go through his whole logic about it. And therefore, at least in theory, every couple in that town is obligated to bring a korban for every time she was a nida. Now, this part I have to say I don't understand fully. It's not every act of marital relations, he says, because there's a concept, whenever you're a shogeg, the concept is whatever you did, behe'elem echad. So behe'elem echad means one not knowing. That's why, for example, we said the tinok shenishba, the baby who was raised in an environment where they didn't know anything about Judaism, so they'll only bring one korban for all of the Shabbatot they didn't keep at the end, because it's all part of one hell. It was one not knowing involved. So in the case of women, says the Tzanz Rebbe, halacha is, it's true, she goes to mikvah, she thinks she's okay, she comes back, they have, you know, let's say over the time till she's a need again, they have X number of marital relations. That'll clearly only be one korban, because it's all in one hell. But, as the Tzanz Rebbe says, the next time she saw, so he thinks that separates it, and therefore that would be a new one. So the Rambam actually says that, this is what the Rambam says. She was Nida, and then he didn't realize she was Nida, so they had relations, or they didn't realize that you're not allowed to have relations, which is Nida, and then she went to mikvah, and she became Tahara. Right? And then another time she became a Nida, and they did it again, and it happened again, whatever. So the Rambam says every act of going to mikvah, becoming tahora, separates. The Tzanz Rebbe seems to assume that would be here too, that every time she went to mikvah, that would separate them. I'm not sure why that is, because going to mikvah meant nothing, because the mikvah was puzzle, so I'm not sure what he means by that, but in any case, A, we're running out of time, B, I don't get to arguments with other Meshivim, but he thinks that fundamentally, the people in that town are obligated, each of the couples are obligated, each of them, to bring korbanot for each time the woman was in Ida and went to mikvah, even though they're going to mikvah didn't count. And besides that, right, other than that, the Mor Horah went himself, and so he says, and certainly nobody knows how many times it was, right? Nobody keeps records of all these things, and the Magen Avraham actually in Hilchot Shabbat, Shin Lamed Dalid, gives an actual, the Shulchan Aruch gives an actual amount of money that you give for every chatat, because the theory was that halachically, if you know that you're chayav of this korban, you should set aside that amount of money, and then God willing, the Beit HaMikdash will be rebuilt, you'll buy the korban, the amount of money that the korban would be worth, the sacrifice would be worth, you'll have the money ready to buy it. In our case, they don't know how much money to put aside because they have no idea of how many things they did. And as you said to them, you know what, fast one time for each time you should owe a korban. They also, A, they don't know how many. It would be a lot and it would be way too much. So what are you going to do? Right? So that's the challenge. And I think another element of this was that this is a challenge to think about. Forget this town. But I think, God willing, the basement will be rebuilt. A lot of us will have that situation because we don't remember how many things we did. Because it's not only nida issues, right? It's not only marital relations issues. It's keeping Shabbos issues. And every different kind of malacha on Shabbos can obligate its own korban chatat. So it's all these questions about what we're going to do about shogeg in these situations. Theoretically, we'd be setting aside money at times we realize we violated Shabbat at a Torah level that would obligate a korban, but I'm not sure we always know that, and then we should put that aside. And then aside from that, those who think you would fast, and we've got a problem with that because people aren't able to do that, and therefore, Sanz Rebbe's advice is, so just explain to them the sin that they did. And let everybody put aside money according to their ability, according to their wealth. Let them also fast a Monday, Thursday, Monday. And you can hope that Hashem will, and you can assume that Hashem will give you kapara because it was a shogeg. It's not, they didn't mean to do it, it's a shogeg. But they have to make sure that they really repent of it. He points to Rabbeinu Yonah in the beginning of Brachos. Tamid Rabbeinu Yonah, commentary on the Rif at the back of the Gemara in the beginning of Brachos. It points out that the Torah required for an Asham Tolu. An Asham Tolu is a sacrifice you bring in certain cases where you don't know if you committed a sin or not. Torah makes that sacrifice cost a lot more than the sacrifice you'd bring if you did know you had done that sin. Rabbeinu Yonah says, and that's because it's a lot harder to do tshuva when you don't know you did a sin than it is to do tshuva when you know you did a sin. When you don't know you did a sin, you say, maybe I didn't even do the sin. And the point is, you didn't do tshuva for not knowing, for having done an act that might have been a sin. He says, that's much harder. See, here too, Sanz Rebbe closed with the idea that they have to make sure that they stress to people that there was a sin here. It wasn't the sin of willingly and premeditatedly and wrongfully having relations after the wife hadn't gone to mikvah, but it was a sin of not having gone to mikvah, and that too is a serious sin, and they need to do tshuva for that. So, a bunch of strong and important ideas about what counts as a shogeg, about what kinds of mistakes are a shogeg, what we do when we're a shogeg, how shogeg is different than ones, on the 15th of Iyar, from the Sanz Rebbe, from the 15th of Iyar of 1861, with thanks to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, to David Hochhauser. Have a great day.